You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. I'm Sam. On tonight's program, Liz talks with Carolyn Hayes about her memoir, A Girlhood, Letter to My Transgender Daughter. Self-aware and intimate, A Girlhood asks us all to love better, not just for the sake of Hayes' child, but for children everywhere enduring injustice and prejudice just as they begin to understand themselves. A Girlhood is a call to action, an ode to community, a plea for empathy, and a hope for a better future.
And I'm Molly Ray. In the last part of the hour, we will be playing one of our legendary legacy episodes. Join us as we do a deep dive in the archives to play an interview from the past. All of this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hey, Liz, how are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Doing well. You are on the air right now. Just wait for Carolyn to come on.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Carolyn.
Hi, Carolyn. Welcome to Right On Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great. We're looking forward to our interview here. Do you want to start with we're speaking with Carolyn Hayes, author of A Girlhood Letter to My Transgender Daughter. And would you start with the reading?
I sure can. I can just read from the beginning a little bit. What would you like, a page?
3 to 5 minutes, so a page, maybe two.
Okay, great. I'll just jump in.
Yes.
This is not a tragedy, but it started the way so many tragedies do, in a quiet and awful way, a common occurrence, a weary dailiness to it. It started with a knock at the front door. I didn't hear the knock. I was writing in the mother-in-law's suite connected to the house by what we called the breezeless way. Your older sister answered the knock and then came to get me. This moment, this knock, changed our lives forever. It created fissures that remain. This was our lives before it. This was our lives after it. Everything changed. There was panic and loss and a kind of fear that never really goes away. You were at its center, but we protected you from it, your father and I, your older sister, and your two older brothers. It was a story that I finally told you when you were 9 years old. We'd left that house by then. We'd left that southern state. We'd moved more than 1,000 miles away, due north. But I worried that the story might pop up in conversations unexpectedly, from an aunt, a friend, someone assuming you knew about it because it was about you. I didn't want you to hear it from someone else. I told you a pared-down version, sitting on a sunny sofa in our living room. We'd moved so many times that the sunny sofa blurs in my mind from one living room to the next, like each living room is a train car zipping past. The story went like this. A man was at the door, sent from the Department of Children and Families. He was there to investigate us as parents. There had been a complaint. The complaint was about you being transgender, and we quickly learned that in this southern state, with Republican-appointed judges, we could lose custody. We could lose you. This is what I try to explain. The knock at the door and what happened in the days and weeks and months that followed. When I finished, you didn't have any questions and you never asked to hear the story again. But I think you deserve to have it in full. It belongs to you. I'm committed to telling you the brutal truths of this story, your story. For a long time, I haven't known how, but now I do. I'll also tell you the beautiful truths. This is how it should be. This is how we should prepare children for the world. I don't know how to prepare children for the world. What happened upended us and yet oriented us. Before the knock at the door, our idea of family, of what would we do for each other in crisis, was theoretical. It became manifest. What happened to us shouldn't happen to anyone, but it did, and it keeps happening, especially to families like ours. How we responded made us understand who we are. What we did for you, we suddenly understood we would do for any of us. In the end, though, this is just one part of your larger story, and it doesn't define you.
That's Carolyn Hayes, author of A Girlhood Letter to My Transgender Daughter. I want to start with a broad question that you deal with many times in the book. What is the difference between gender identity and sexuality?
Oh, I think that usually people say quite simply, sexual orientation is who you love, who do you fall for? Do you fall for men? Do you fall for women? Do you fall for both? And then gender is really, who you are. Are you more of a woman inside a man, a girl, a boy, and then again, some people also are on that spectrum and kind of move between the two and don't really fit and are non-binary.
I'd like to know, well, perhaps if you want to share how old your daughter is and perhaps how old you are, but in any case, what inspired you to write this book right now?
Well, I was a writer. I mean, I've always been a writer. I have a long career as a writer. And so I always knew that I'd write the book. I mean, I was certainly writing other work at the time and, but I was always taking notes. So it's been, over 10 years since this incident happened. So I was taking notes. I always knew what I was writing was more interesting and more beautiful and complex and layered and scary and everything, so much more to it than the stories that I was writing at the time. But I had to wait until my daughter was old enough to tell me it was okay. And so she's now about to turn 16. So I was writing the book a while back. And I also thought, I thought things would get better and the book wouldn't be very necessary. That was my hope because things were getting better across the country for a large part of my daughter's childhood. There were more laws protecting kids and trans kids and families and access to healthcare and, pronouns and all the good stuff. So things were so much better. And then things really took a turn. Now what happened to us with that knock at the door, which seemed like just a very strange bureaucratic mix-up. We're a loving family, with leading experts telling, talking to us in conversation, like making good decisions. It's now the law in Texas. So, the governor of that state decided that it is actually a mandate that if you know somebody who's supporting their transgender child, you should, report them to the Department of Children and Families. So
God.
that's actually become policy.
Goodness. How old was your daughter when she knew she was a girl?
Well, so they actually have these, the American Academy of Pediatrics has studied this. They've studied it mainly with people like me. I'm not transgender, so but in childhood development, they've looked at when at what age do it does a kid kind of realize what gender is, like it starts to express their gender, knows who they are, then kind of knows that that gender is fixed for them, by like 4 or 5. Because they have, other milestones that they're reaching. So my daughter did all of those things really quite very much on the regular old chart. She just did them in the reverse of the way we expected her to. So it is not unusual to talk to, adult trans people who really some of their earliest memories are, why am I getting this toy? Why am I not being treated, as a girl when I so clearly I feel like a girl inside. So she was, kind of consistent, persistent, and cute as soon as she could speak, and was, very, very insistent with us that we got it wrong. when we got it wrong. So even by like age 4, she was telling her teachers that she was a girl. She was arguing with other kids and her classmates, although she's a sweetheart. I mean, she doesn't argue in a negative way. She's a sweetheart. But yeah, so around there, I would say.
I don't know if you've ever thought this way or not, but I know some people do. When did you understand that this was not, quote, just a phase she was going through, but that it was her truth?
Well, for one thing, I wasn't afraid of the idea that she might desist. I mean, I was afraid that, oh, we'd allow her to choose her pronouns and wear the clothes that she wanted to, and then she'd change her mind. But a lot of people, I mean, what we were modeling there was, look, you can do this, and we'll support you. And there was very specifically a moment that I will get to, but. And we'll support you. We're kind of by making that kind of smooth and being open. We also were showing like, hey, it's no big deal if you decide to no longer identify as a girl, right? Because so we're keeping that very open for her, that space very open for her. But I would say that there was this one time I was putting her to bed one night at my mother's house. We were visiting and we were saying prayers, and then we were going to bed, and Maybe, I don't know what, but something had happened earlier in the day. And she said to me, when you say I'm beautiful, say she is beautiful. Say she. And to me, you know, as a person of faith, that felt so divine, like that the person, like when somebody tells you what makes them beautiful and how to respect their inner beauty, like their innermost beauty, I just felt like you don't mess with that. And so that was when I really started to take it more seriously. And I felt like she had expressed herself so clearly in that moment. And it had been so consistent also for a long time, even by that point. So that was the moment.
You know, I was thinking, I bet you don't like this word any more than I do, the word let, allow. You supported her. You didn't let her. You can't let somebody be who they are. It's not our place to allow somebody to be who they are. We support. And it sounds like you did support her a great deal. And your husband as well.
There's a great a quote from Saint Francis de Sales, be who you are and be that well. Be who you are and be that well. And so that was something that was important to us. She was who she was, you know, and she just has to just to do that well, be authentic in yourself. Yeah, my husband was. And you know, when you go to the group meetings for parents, you know, who are new to this, who are struggling, who are challenged, it's usually women who show up. It's the moms who show up at those meetings in large part. They tend to be the ones who are more attuned and more leaned in and more ready to support. But my husband was very much on board. I mean, he had his own, you know, mishigas to go through. Like he had to, you know, he had his own masculinity issues. Like, is this a reflection of me as a man? Are people going to think of me differently? Blah, blah, blah. It was so ridiculous once he said it out loud that he was like, yeah, that's not how masculinity works. That's not, and I'm not going to, you know, make my child's life miserable because I want to be seen more as a man. That's not actually what a good person does. So he got over that quickly. And then he's been a great champion. He's helped a lot of other families. He's done support groups for fathers who are struggling with this idea. He's done well.
Talk some about the woman in the support group who said they always blame the mothers. That comes up several times in how you're feeling and what you're going through. We need to talk about that a little bit.
I mean, well, the history of psychology in America is so dominated by Freud, which was definitely a blame the
Yeah, really.
mother psychology. So we've gotten over that a good bit, thank goodness. So I really came to appreciate that woman. There were not support groups at that time for parents. So the only support, at least in the town I was in, so the only group that I could go to, and they were lovely and invited me, were actually trans people themselves, you know, supporting each other in their journeys. So I show up at this meeting. They're so lovely to me. I give my spiel, everybody goes around and gives their spiel. I give mine, and they're just so supportive. And then there's one woman, it's kind of sitting back, looking at me. And she has a different take. And her take is, look, you know, I see you doing your thing, but just watch out because when this comes back, and it will, they're going to blame you. They always blame the mother. And I was rattled by it in the moment. And the group kind of gave her a hard time because it was not the nicest thing to say. You know, it was like, and I think that she had like a snarky history in the group. It was so helpful to me that she was honest in that moment. And when the time came and somebody did make an anonymous call and that threat was very present, and I definitely felt blamed as a mother, it was so much easier for me to kind of accept that was happening because I'd been warned, you know? And I did see that woman again later. I got to thank her for being honest with me about her experience as a trans person. And how valuable those groups are, you know what I mean? And the intergenerational groups, kind of the older LGBTQ community, talking to the younger one, passing down those lessons, because it was easier not to take it as personally. I could see myself fitting into history, a history of, you know, They always blame the mother.
Talk about the knock on the door and all the things that this is a big question, I know, but what happened and how did you have to deal with it? Dealing with lawyers and talking to people and getting those letters together. Talk about all that stuff, if you may.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, it's so funny. I'm such an upsider. Like, we were lucky, but we were lucky in that we had people, you know, in our around us who jumped in. So the next door neighbor is a lawyer, certainly not his expertise at all. He's like real estate law and, you know, bankruptcy laws. Such a great guy. And not somebody who would have supported his kids. We definitely, you know, if he had a trans kid, we definitely talked about those things. We certainly disagreed, but very, you know, respectfully. And so he got me in touch when I told him what was going on. He immediately got me in touch with somebody who, a lawyer who it was a specialty. And that lawyer explained to me how quickly things could go badly, that if the caseworker would have to interview everybody in the family, not everybody was there the first day. So he had to come back the next day. And so if he showed up with a police officer, that meant that they were going to take my child then. And so I had to have an address ready, friends of the family or family members who would be willing to immediately take the child into their home. That we might be in a situation where we could choose blame, like one of the two of us, my husband or I, could choose blame, and then that parent would be taken out of the home, but the rest of the family would stay together and the child would be able to stay in the home. So that lawyer was incredibly frank and told me very, very clearly how I would be perceived and painted in a courtroom, and that if we got a Republican judge, as I kind of said in the beginning, we could lose custody. So another friend happened to just be checking in. She's from very far away, but was raising an older trans son and was just checking in to say hi. And I told her what was going on. And she said, I'm putting you in touch with an expert. So this was a woman who, you know, had helped other families. And so she had a plan. Like, again, we had to create a safe folder overnight. And the safe folder had to be full of letters from people who knew us as parents and could vouch for us as upright citizens, as people who, you know, were good in the community. And so we had letters from, you know, a friend of ours who was a psychologist, a friend who was a nurse. We had the people who taught our child at school. We had a minister who wrote a letter on our behalf, family, you know, all these letters poured in. I mean, people really put the brakes on that night, as we called them that night, and wrote these letters and letters from our doctor to the pediatrician, everything we could. So, yes, so though it was a lot, it was very overwhelming. And, one thing was that they, you know, even if we could prove that our house was safe and good, it never made the threat go away, because if somebody else called, we'd have to start over again. You know what I mean? So it was this, and we never knew who made the call. So it just never could be lovingly like confronted and addressed and forgiven. And, you know, it just was out there.
Sounds like the investigator was a little annoyed by it. That I think, didn't he say something like, I wish they'd send me to families that really had a problem?
Yeah. And I think that's a really, really important thing to talk about right now in this country, because we're doing, a lot of people are saying that they're very concerned. A lot of Republicans in office are saying, I'm very concerned about trans kids, and I'm concerned that, you know, about this and blah, 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 and they're putting all these laws out there to take away their access to healthcare and insurance and, you know, sports teams and all these things. And honestly, you know, and then they create panic in other people too, that, you know, and so really your concern is for a family like ours. You know, my daughter's thriving. She's, you know, she does really well in school. Math is a little bit of a struggle. She's in honors classes, you know, she's great. And she's got sweet family, and you know, she's well fed, and like, you know, we're good. Like, you know, we've got great doctors, we've got great everything going on, we're okay. But putting your concern on us allows you to like kind of create a scapegoat. But meanwhile, just like that that caseworker who knew that there were children who were truly in danger, who were not being fed, who were going to bed hungry, who were being mistreated in their homes or mistreated in their, in other foster placements or wherever they were, There are children all over the world who actually need our active love and concern. If poverty, by focusing negatively on these well-supported, loving families of trans kids, you're putting all this energy, put your energy on the fact that, in a country, in a, well, in a state like Texas, which is bigger than many countries at 39 million people almost, address the poverty, address, the children who are deeply, deeply in need in your own state, who are crying out for help. We're like, hey, thanks for your concern, but please stop being concerned about us. There's truly, truly people who are very, very much in need. And so it is a way to distract and deflect and also create, hostility and have a scapegoat and create dehumanized people, like families like ours, dehumanize us and then make us something to fear, which is good sometimes for rallying a base, but it's very bad for communities and it's very bad for families. It's very bad for children.
Speaking of dehumanizing, you had some real problems with the insurance companies and what they wanted to call this situation to get it covered.
Yes, I was actually on the books. I had a kind of a sweet representative at an insurance company I won't name, and it was his job to go into the system and explain the exact reason why we were being denied coverage, which at that point was, I believe, the term was psychosexual deviance. And at that time, and again, like we're not talking about major surgeries. There was nothing. We were just getting basic care for our daughter and having conversations about how best to support her. There's nothing going on here that's actually scary or, irreversible. There's nothing irreversible. And at that point, our daughter was like, 9 years old. And my response back to him was, well, she still believes in Santa Claus. I think it's a little bit early to label her a psychosexual deviant, right? And it
Yeah.
just felt so discriminatory. It feels so discriminatory for a child, but it feels equally discriminatory just for a person who, a trans man or woman who wants to get, health care, for their own issues.
We're speaking with Carolyn Hayes, author of A Childhood Letter to My Transgender Daughter. We've talked about the knock at the door. How did it change your life?
Yeah, well, it changed everything. I mean, it changed things on a very practical level. We, the case was eventually closed, and but we never had closure, ourselves. And so we moved. I mean, we moved back north. We looked at the whole entire country and maps and tracking laws and places that would be, progressive and would have protective stuff on the books. It uprooted our kids and their lives, older children. We have four kids. But also I just want to say too that, that first line is this is not a tragedy. I think it made us better people. I mean, I think it made us so much more compassionate, not just about the trans community or the LGBTQ community, although we've learned a ton about the complexity and gorgeous diversity of gender, which is all around us all the time, but we don't pay attention to. But it also just expanded us as human beings. It made us so much more compassionate for all different kinds of people who have to live in a heightened state of fear in this country for various reasons. Yeah, so it really, I think, helped us to grow, kind of kicked the doors of our heart wide open.
How did she enjoy middle school? What was good about that? It sounds like there were some good experiences for her in middle school.
Yeah, she had a great middle school. She's very soft-spoken, so we're always looking for opportunities for her to, use her big voice. So there she got to be much more outspoken. It was a really small school, incredibly. They'd already had an experience, experiences with trans students, so they had it all together. And yeah, so it was a small, very sweet community, and she definitely got better at, like giving her opinion, being a leader of the group, all of those good things. She got to practice those skills. So she kind of came, she, you know, kind of came into her own a good bit in middle school.
And then you were looking for a high school, and one of the things you did was approach a Catholic school. Why don't you talk about your experiences with the Catholic Church and education?
Yeah, so I went to Catholic school, and so I was actually looking at Catholic schools where I was that I knew very well, and yeah, so at first I thought that we actually had a shot. I mean, I actually thought we had a shot because some of the people who, you know, that were on our side were wonderful nuns, and the Monsignor who had, you know, baptized our daughter, they were all on board and incredible, incredible. So, yeah, but then we actually went and we were kind of pushed from school to school to talk to the superintendent of the Catholic schools of the diocese. The first meeting went, again, like incredibly well. And, you know, he got to know us as a family. And I think he got to know our daughter, although she wasn't there. He got to know the way we spoke about our daughter and really raised the education level. And at the end of that meeting, he said, great, you know what I would be great is if you could do some work to dig around and kind of give me an argument that I could bring to nuns and priests that would help give context to the students within the Catholic tradition, which, you know, that was what I that was what I knew. And I went and did that like a good Catholic schoolgirl. I did my homework. I looked at the documents from the Vatican, which were great. And, you know, made an argument, brought it back. And the second meeting was over very quickly. And she was, you know, banned from, it was banned from all the high schools in the diocese. Wait, she could have gone, you know, as a boy, I suppose, you know, with boy pronouns and whatnot, which at that point would have just been ridiculous. And, but yeah, so, I still try to keep in touch sometimes. Actually, I haven't reached out recently. I should, with the head of the diocese, because I know that they have trans kids, actively have trans kids, among their student body. And I still feel like there's a way to be within the Catholic faith very much so, and be incredibly open and loving to trans people and to support them in communities.
Carolyn, I'm afraid we have run out of time. I think that is a kind of a good way to end, to talk about loving, to
yes.
talk about love and also dignity and respect, which I think is something that you've been talking about the whole time. So thank you so much. And thank you for being flexible. Carolyn was going to be on at 7:30 and she decided that since we needed her at 7, she would come on at 7. So thank you for your flexibility.
Absolutely.
And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
I loved it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
This is a section called The Beginning. Here we are. All is still. All is still, silent and waiting. All is silent and calm, hushed and empty as the womb of the sky. These are the first words. This is the first speaking. There is not yet one person, one animal, bird, fish, crab, tree, rock, hollow, canyon, field, or woven forest. The broad sky is all alone. The face of the earth is not yet here. The expanse of sea is all alone, along with the womb of the sky. Nothing has been gathered. All is at rest. Nothing stirs. All is drowsing. Nothing stands. Only the breadth of water. Only the tranquil sea. There is no thought of what might be. All lies dark and silent in the only night. Then came the word. Heart of sky arrived in the dark of the only night. Heart of sky arrived with Sovereign and Quetzal Serpent. They talked together then. They pondered and wondered. They reached an accord, braiding together their words and their thoughts. They heartened one another, and it came clear. the conception of humans born beneath a luminous sky. Then they conceived the generations of trees and the generations of thickets, the germination of all life in the darkness of pale dawn by heart of sky, who is called Hurricane. Lightning Hurricane is first, newborn thunderbolt is second, sudden lightning is third. These three gods as one are heart of sky. They came together with Sovereign and Quetzal Serpent. Their joining conceived both light and life. How shall it be sown? They asked. When should dawn come? Who will feed these worlds? Who will sustain them? Let it be like this. Let the water clear away so the plate of earth comes toward the light. Let the land gather and level out. Then it can be sown. Then the dawn can come. But there will be no words of praise or prayer to sing of what we frame and shape until humanity is born, until true people have been made, they said. When it was time to make the earth, it only took a word. To make earth, they said earth. And there it was, sudden as a cloud or mist unfolds from the face of a mountain. So earth was there.
Michael Bazette is the author of You Must Remember This, which received the 2014 Lindquist and Venom Prize for Poetry and The Interrogation. He is also the translator of the Popol Vuh, the first English verse translation of the Mayan creation epic, and the chapbook Imaginary City. His poems have appeared in numerous publications, including Plowshares, The Sun, Massachusetts Review, Pleiades, and Best New Poets. A longtime faculty member at the Blake School, Bazette has received the Bechdel Prize from Teachers and Writers Collaborative and is a 2017 National Endowment for the Arts Fellow. He lives in Minneapolis. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so a delight. Perfect. Can you first give us a general overview of the Popol Vuh? What are its origins? What is its story?
Well, it's a Mayan, I call it a creation epic, because in a way, the beginning and ending sections are a creation myth, and embedded inside the creation myth is what's pretty a classic epic, you know, to except, you know, the only difference is that it's enacted by hero twins instead of, you know, the individual hero that's maybe more common in the sort of the Western conception. But those hero twins need to basically set things right so that the creation of the world can be made complete. It's a nice intermingling. It's kind of like Genesis, Gilgamesh, and the Odyssey kind of rolled into one tidy package. They literally travel to the underworld to overcome the lords of death and then are reborn, which sort of establishes a cycle of regeneration, which is really linked to the agricultural cycle. They become the sun and the moon. We're all set
for
them, the world to be born.
And the passage you just read was entitled "The Beginning." It was the beginning of the creation myth. Is that right? Can you tell us a little bit about that passage?
Sure. It was actually that moment. One of the things that drew me to the project of translating it, which you know, was kind of immense and took 10 years. but I really, I found that moment fascinating for a number of reasons. Not the least of which is, I don't know if you noticed, but it's. Begins in the present tense. And I love that notion of the creation of the world happening as the story is unfolding, you know, and something that is ongoing. I also love the fact that it comes from a conversation as opposed to, you know, with my upbringing way back in the Catholic cornfields of Rochester, it was all about, you know, that one single voice saying, let there be light, and things sort of happening. And I think that conception of the world arising from conversation instead of a pronouncement really appealed to me. And so in this particular section, it's right at the very beginning. Earth is created using language. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. The myth has a profound sense and understanding of language as this generative tool. But what's interesting is that the test of people, once people, true humans being created, is that they need to be able to speak intelligently back to the gods who created them.
It's a wonderful sort of cyclical phenomenon that happens.
Yeah, I'll create you and you create me.
So let's talk a little bit. You said it took 10 years for you to translate this. Can you talk a little bit about your entry into this project and where it took you?
Sure. I mean, 10 years kind of from conception and fiddling with it. I think it chose me far more than I chose it. And if I'd known, I think, the arc and the scope of it, I probably would have been a lot more daunted. But it's one of the things about the Popol Vuh that's so wonderful is that it is just on a surface level such a good story. I mean, you could sit down and tell it to an 8-year-old and they'd be enthralled.
Yes,
you know, and that's
yes.
one of the things I love about mythology. It also means there's lots of tasty bite-sized pieces that I could try and sort of cut my teeth on a little bit. And then the myth got its hooks into me and I realized I really wanted to try and get the arc of the mythic section completed. It started when I had a sabbatical in 2007, 2008, and lived in central Mexico at the time, and started to learn a lot about Aztec and Mayan folklore and mythology. And on the side, I was translating a lot of Spanish poetry just to help me learn Spanish. And so the project kind of accidentally came out of the convergence of me becoming fascinated with the process of translation, which is, translation's kind of like a drug. It's wonderful. You know, you can keep returning to it, and you know, it's a little bit endless. I was translating Neruda because there's like 15 translations of every Neruda poem in English, and then I could put mine side by side with people who knew what they were doing, and that was really fascinating.
Yeah.
And yeah, lo and behold, so it was born.
And how long did the actual process of translation take?
The body of the manuscript itself, I think, about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I have a day job.
Yes. I imagine that work was just wholly rewarding and enriching. Did you find that so?
Yeah. In fact, I got obsessed enough that I ended up taking an unpaid leave from the Blake School long time ago. I think it was the spring of 2011,
mm-hmm.
For a semester, simply because once I would get the cadences of the poem in my head that I wanted to write, it would begin to flow.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when it would get truncated by a summer break and I'd have to put it away, it was, you know, then I would take a while to pick up the thread, and I just really wanted to create some time so I could just fully inhabit it, because it's, you know, it's a big story.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. It is. So speaking of story, I'd like to dive into it just a little bit. Two of the main players in the story are the twins. Let me see if I can get this right now. Hunapu and Xibalanque.
Yeah, Hunapu and Xibalanque.
And these are twin, they're sort of tricksters.
Yeah.
A little bit, born of the god Juan Hunapu. What characterizes these boys? Why do you think they're so vital to this story?
That's a great question. And I think the key word in what you just said, besides trickster and vital, is that they're boys.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of interesting that they seem eternally young,
mm-hmm.
Even though clearly there's kind of an immense amount of time that passes, especially if you account for that seven macaw section early on. It's kind of hard to locate yourself in time. But their playfulness really appeals to me. And the fact, too, that the center of, you know, what we would call the epic or the adventure part is not founded on a hero. A individual, but a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. You know, it's their brothers, but they're friends. One becomes the sun and one becomes the moon. There's a pretty clear hierarchy, but the result of that isn't one feeling sidelined. It's more the outcome of that is stability and balance and equilibrium. And they work very well together. There are a few moments where Xibalanque kind of is the moon character, the reflecting character, eclipses, you know, Hunapu in all his glory and the sun character. For instance, when Hunapu's been decapitated and, yeah. you know, Xibalanque needs to step up. So it's just that wonderful sort of accidental metaphor provided by the cosmos, where the moon is somehow exactly the same size as the sun from our perspective.
My younger sister would love to hear that. And as Xibalanque replaces Hunapu's head with a squash,
yeah.
which I love. It's fantastic. Yeah, they're definitely tricksters, and so godlike, though, you know, so incredibly powerful, but they never lose that innocence.
And playfulness, yeah.
And playfulness.
Nor do the older gods, you know. I love the fact that it takes a few drafts to get humanity right. A god who's into revision, I'm down with.
Yes. another character I absolutely loved was Lady Blood.
Yeah.
In the tale of Lady Blood and the Tree of One Hunapu. She is a maiden of the Lords of Death. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And she ends up conceiving these trickster twins in sort of a virgin birth.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit more about Lady Blood and why you think she makes such a compelling sort of heroine.
Wow. That's, you know, she's got a little touch of Eve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's with the tree and there's some strange fruit, but she's also, in that case, if you're going to evoke that story, and of course this predates that and wouldn't have overlapped with that story overtly, although Joseph Campbell might have some things to say about that. You know, how far back these stories go, we don't know. But so, yeah, there's an echo of Eve there as kind of, but also the serpent.
Mm-hmm.
She's both. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the one who says, I will not die. I will not be lost. You know, in Eve, we separate out the temptation into the evil serpent, and we give sort of the purity and elements of desire to the woman. And Lady Blood has both,
mm-hmm.
you know. There are times, too, when she reminds me a little bit of Snow White having to outwit her wicked stepmother, you know.
There's a line I love. So the Lords of Chibalba, though that's the Lords of Death, were defeated because a maiden duped them blind.
Yeah.
I hear your voice in that as well, as a little bit of that sort of playfulness, again, echoes of that.
I very much, yeah, that was, my job, I felt, the metaphor I kept returning to while I was doing it is I wanted to be a bridge,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, so in the sense, there's a lot of structure I was providing, and it, in some ways it's a bold move, but also one thing I love about translation is how it completely, it negates the writer and the ego. You're mm-hmm. really there. To function as a vessel to someone else's story and words. So you really learn how to listen and read, you know, as much as write.
As the myth concludes, it was so powerful, so emotional and moving. The image of the animals kind of coming down from the mountain and the sea creatures rise up from the river and they're here to witness this new dawn, this first sun. What was your relationship to the text as you kind of dived deeper, as the more you got through those 5 years of the process? How do you feel you were changed by this translation?
Oh, that's a good question. I love, it's interesting, you know, I did cherry pick a little bit early on, you know, for sections,
mm-hmm.
but I did that final section that you were just referencing right at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
I think the section where the first day actually dawns, the sun and the moon come up and all the animals begin to cry out and roar, you know, and there's this chorus. And I'll be honest, I found it deeply moving. It was, It touched me in a way that surprised me a little bit, too, because there is that element in being a translator where you're somewhat of a technician. I knew the story. I knew it was coming. You know, there mm-hmm. wasn't necessarily an element of surprise there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet at the same time, when I felt it had started to find its form and cadence and rhythm in English, it was kind of like a veil falling away. And I saw that part of the story for the first time. You know, I remember welling up a little bit and thinking, yeah. oh my God. You know,
I did too.
This has happened. Well, that's wonderful.
So I wanted to return back to this idea of the power of language and naming, you know, as someone who was also grew up in the Catholic neighborhoods, in the Catholic fields, you know, I think of Let There Be Light. I think of this, mm-hmm. this declaration of presence and then suddenly the world is. And I thought the choices of the framer and the shaper,
mm-hmm.
naming the gods in that way was really interesting. Could you talk a little bit about the framer and the shaper? And did you choose those words? Was that a translation?
Well, they're pretty straight translations
from the
K'iche, I would say. I mean, a number of people have used those. There's many translations of this that are scholarly. This is the first one that's in verse.
Right.
That was the thing that set it apart. And I was also very much trying to just put foreground that really good story element. So it was lucid. Basically, so someone could just lie down in a hammock and read it without the scholarly footnotes and having to be a Mayanist or an anthropologist or anything.
Right.
and I think that the you know, the feeling underneath that was approaching it as a reader, as a poet, but also as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. The language was so vivid, so imagaic. Each translation, you know, I can feel the sort of the ancient wisdom that comes out of it, the sense that these words have existed for a very long time, mm-hmm. from the point of origin, certainly, but, you know, who knows, maybe even before that.
Yeah. Well, and framer and shaper are nice, too, because they imply that there was already something there.
Yeah.
I think that God of Genesis that you're evoking, it's actually ambiguous syntactically, if you go back and look, you know, but there's no doubt that the Mayan gods were working with materials that are already there. They were much more artists than the magic trick where it was something from nothing.
Mm.
And that, too, I think, resonates with anyone who is using language to try and create a reality. There's a long legacy of that before you, and you need to kind of, you know, take that into account.
Kind of honor it, I think.
Yeah.
You say in your introduction that the myth unhinges from linear progression, which is something that I've been focused on in my own writing, this idea that the story circles back on itself over and over again, each time rewriting itself just a little bit, each time adding new detail, focusing more on emotions and these tropes. And what was it like to sort of deconstruct that complex narrative to tell it in a way, like you said, you can read it while lying on a hammock, you know, it was easy to understand and yet it was so complex at the same time.
Yeah, it helps not to think about it too much.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there is that kind of, you know, sliding doors or memento element to it, where if you start to look at the linear chronology, and yet at the same time, it reminded me kind of the Arabian Nights, how Scheherazade will be into a story, and then a character inside that story will begin to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
So you get interrupted, and that story's nested, and then one will be nested in that. And so there's this Russian doll construction where you get into kind of the center story and then have to find your way back out. So we begin with the creation of the world and then a few drafts of humanity. And then we get this pretender who's kind of in this dim light of a pre-dawn world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the hero twins come in and deal with him. Then we're like, well, where did they come from?
Mm-hmm.
And then we suddenly are like, well, here are their fathers. What happened to them? And it's like, oh, and here's how the boys were born,
mm-hmm.
you know? And, you know, we go through all of that until we come somehow out the other end of like, oh, now they've become the sun and the moon. And it's like, when did Seven Macaw happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's hard to tell, you know? And of course, once the sun and the moon rays and true humans are created out of corn, it turns out that was the secret ingredient. I love that.
Just took a little bit of maize and water, that's all.
And then true humans are made. They're able to speak intelligently and mirror back the names of their creators and their gratitude for being created. So they use language in the way that it's meant to be used. And suddenly we're back in that first story again, and it's finally finished. Yeah.
Would you like to read a couple more minutes of a passage?
Sure, sure.
Thank you.
Do you have a preference? We could look at Lady Blood or we could just...
I would love to look at Lady Blood.
Okay. This then is the story of a maiden, the daughter of the Lord named Gathered Blood. I'm going to interrupt for a second because names like Gathered Blood and Pus Fiend and Flying Scab, you know, they're pretty irresistible. There's something about them too that really appeals to like the 12-year-old, you know, comic nerd inside.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. What's your dad's name? Gathered Blood. This then is the story of a maiden, the daughter of the Lord named Gathered Blood. She was the daughter of a lord and thus was known as Lady Blood. When she heard the account of the fruit tree from her father, she was astonished by the tale. Now I'll interrupt here just to highlight that the fruit that's hanging in the tree is the skull, the decapitated skull of one Hunapu. Can't I somehow see this tree to better understand its strangeness? I've heard that the fruit is truly delicious, she said. And she left alone to wander beneath the calabash tree at Devastation Ball Court. Ah, what is this fruit? How could it not be delicious, the fruit borne by this tree? I will not die. I will not be lost. Who would even hear if I picked one? Asked the maiden. And then the skull spoke there in the midst of the tree. What could you desire from this? It's just bone, a round thing stuck in the branches, said the head of one Hunapu when it spoke to the maiden. You do not desire it, she was told. But I do desire it, said the maiden. Then open your right hand and reach up into the branches so that I can see it, said the skull. Very well, said the maiden, and she stretched her right hand up to the face of the skull, and it squeezed out a little spit into her open palm. Then she looked into her hand. She wasted no time, but the skull's saliva was gone.
What were those lines that, but I do desire it, that sort of fierceness, I love.
Yes, that assertion of desire is so wonderful.
So in a few minutes, we'll be wrapping up here, but I wanted to mention in the Adroit Journal, it recently published a reflection on writing a poem, which I love, called The Epidemic. And you say, I don't know why, but this is something I think about a lot. The power of what remains unspoken, what cannot be spoken of silence itself. All of these absences are, I think, necessary elements of poetry, composing the emptiness that allows the little bell of the poem to chime. And my question is, there's a lot said in the Popova. It never hides its intentions, but what do you think the silence between the lines, between the verses, is trying to say? What remains unsaid in the Popova?
What a lovely thought. I mean, one of the most interesting moments for me is at the very end, once the hero twins have defeated the lords of death and are victorious, one of the things they do is go to the same tree that Lady Blood, you know, their mother, I mean, that's the moment of their conception. And they say to the skull of their father, you know, name your eyes, name your nose, name your mouth. They, in a way, want him to speak himself back into being. And he says nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, is such a wonderfully resonant silence. They've defeated the lords of death, but there are things that you can't pull back, mm-hmm. you know, from the grave. And I think there is an element, that's one of the reasons I really wanted to, I mean, clearly, when you hear it in the K'iche, there's strong rhythms. It's incantatory. There's cadences at play in it where you hear it, the oral tradition, you know, that gave it structure. In our tradition, you know, we like to have that white space of the page for those rhythms to sort of resonate mm-hmm. in a way. And so I also was just trying to put maybe more silence around the words using all the white space of the page
mm-hmm.
and kind of re-poeming it in English so that some of the unspoken spaces around that would allow what was there to, I don't know, echo a little more loudly.
When I look upon it on the page, you know, the white space, as you say, the sparse lining, it reminds me of like the cavern of a church, right? You have what is present and holy, and then, but you really feel that sort of sacred space all around
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Yeah. How the nave of a cathedral draws the voices and the eyes upward.
Absolutely. So we're on the last minute or so. I was just wondering, going back to the real world, what's coming up next for you, Michael? Do you have any projects in the works or readings coming up?
I am working on a book called The Echo Chamber right now. That's half retelling, half remix of the Narcissus and Echo myth.
Mm.
I can't seem to get away from mythology right now. and I also have just a collection of poems called The Unspoken Joke Book,
mm-hmm.
where I'm kind of exploring how, right now, I feel like, in a way, stand-up comedians can say things that no one else can, which in some ways has long been the job of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of interested about the Venn diagram between those two worlds. So,
absolutely fascinating. Mm-hmm. Well, we have been speaking with Michael Bazette, translator of the Popol Vuh. Michael, thank you so much for coming on Right on Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It was lovely.